All right, we're back in C++ world in compiler land. What's going on?
Hi. My name's Russell, Russell Hadley. I work on Phoenix. I primarily deal with areas in the compiler toward the very last stages of compilation, where we're actually targeting the assembly code that will actually run on the machine.
Okay.
So I deal with very low-level issues that center around resource allocation and the actual generated code for the target.
Nice. The target processor.
Nice. So I'm the guy who really gets the last touch on your code before it gets emitted out into something that's going to run on the machine.
Cool. So I think it would be kind of fun to just quickly just kind of go through, I don't know if quickly is the right term, but so as a front-end developer, the person who writes in the language, the stuff that you get from, you know, the chunk of code I wrote in C++ is going to be very, very different looking than what I, as a craftsman, has presented to the machine.
That's right. You've actually got something that you deal with things like your boss wants good coding conventions. You want your tabs to look right. You want all the text to look, you know, in a pretty way. You want the abstraction to be clear so that people coming on later are going to be able to easily maintain the code. The code that I receive looks more like the code written exactly the way your professor said not to, which is it's all just go-tos and labels.
Ooh.
Right? So it's like just these raw chunks of math, like add this, you know, dereference this, pull this memory in, flip this bit, and then if the value turns out to be between 0 and 20, jump over here and start doing some more work.
Interesting. So what kind of code are you writing every day? Like what, you're writing assembly?
No, what I produce is assembly, but what I write is C++.
Okay.
So I have the same rules on my day-to-day work that you do as a C++ developer.
Cool.
I have to write clear, concrete code that realizes the algorithm I want to implement.
Mm-hmm.
But what I produce, what actually streams through, is something that starts out as the clear code that comes from the programmer and ends up as assembly. So at each stage along the way, I get closer and closer to assembly. And at each one of those stages, some of the abstraction, a for loop, an object, one of these other constructs, they get removed and re-expressed as simpler terms.
Mm.
In those simpler terms, we lose that abstraction, but we're now able to say more concrete things about the machine. How does the add of two structs? So you had like a struct, and you probably when you went through school had a complex number as a simple struct. You had essentially the imaginary part and you had the real part.
Yes.
Right? And so you'd have these two numbers, and like when you added them, you had to have like this, oh, well, I have to go add this part and I have to add this other part, put them together. Well, in C++, we know we can overload the operators such that we deal with adding. We just say, okay, add this complex number. In actuality, when that gets lowered out, it gets lowered down to a set of operations that are directly on the underlying types that the machine has, which will be, in this point, floating point numbers.
Okay.
Right? So it decomposes that problem.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Targeting, and of course you had to do some interesting work probably for a titanium 64-bit processor versus...
Sure. The titanium
is
a really hard target to target. We also have some other ones. We target ARM, which is used in a lot of cell phones. So Windows CE has a lot of interesting targets, of which ARM is one. And then there's obviously x86 and x64. Most people don't really realize as they buy new hardware, these new boxes actually run a 64-bit version of the x86 instruction set. Right, so there is an actual target change underneath there. And you can buy 64-bit Windows, and you can buy 32-bit Windows.
Sure, and you can run 32-bit Windows on a 64-bit processor.
Absolutely. That's one of the smart things they did with the 64-bit move from AMD and Intel is that they've maintained the backward compatibility so that any of the old programs will run on the new platform. But if you have challenging programs you want to run that have to deal with really big data sets, need 64 bits of address space, you can grow into that.
Interesting. So, you know, one of the things I'll ask right off the bat, since you're, you know, given the time that we live in right now and what you do, certainly the many core revolution is going to have an impact on what you do, because not only are you going to have many core processors, you're going to have processors that have, you know, asymmetric cores. In other words, they're not all the same type of execution engine.
Absolutely.
So
absolutely.
That must be incredibly challenging for what you do.
In a way, that is challenging for the technology that we implement. Mm-hmm. And we're planning for it. I mean, this is one of the most exciting areas that we can work in. But it actually makes some of the old things new again. So it used to be, right now we've optimized to try and reduce memory interaction. We want to make cache behavior better. We want to make sure the data is available on the CPU when we implement it. We used to worry about things like scheduling, but the hardware's got so good that we didn't worry about scheduling as much. Mm. Modern architectures have what they call a out-of-order buffer, this big window where it looks ahead in your program, looks way down the road and says, hey, are there operations that I can find way down the road that aren't dependent on the results of current things in flight, and can I execute those? Essentially the same thing that schedulers used to do with the compiler. Mm. But when you start talking about these new heterogeneous chips, they're going to have, you know, a big part that handles the out of order, sort of a traditional thing, but then maybe they'll have, you know, 30, 32, 64 of these old low power in order parts. That'll be like an old x86 that'll be, hey, if someone wants to go in and code that up by hand, they can get something to run really fast, but they're going to have to do the extra work of scheduling it. And it might be a really good solution for something like a DSP application that runs on this platform.
Okay.
So all of this technology, all of these new chips, are things that we actually really want to focus on targeting with Phoenix, and that's why we've gone to the effort to try and make sure our back end has these retargetable features.
Excellent. So, and we've talked to Phoenix on Channel 9 just not too long ago. We interviewed your colleague Andy Ayer.
Andy Ayers, yeah.
And that was very fascinating. I don't want to focus too much of this interview on Phoenix specifically.
Okay.
Unless we want to talk about specifically what you work on Phoenix and how, say, the Phoenix back-end optimizer is that much more improved than the current back-end optimizer. Like,
right,
what are
right.
some of the changes?
Well, you're going to get me in trouble with my colleagues who work on UTC.
Uh-oh.
We start talking
no
about
offense,
what's
guys. All right.
Not to get too deep into Phoenix, but particularly I work on register allocation and a lot of instruction set level, low-level optimizations, which primarily center around problems of resource allocation. It could be that I had, for some reason, the lower generated two additions in a row of a constant value. Maybe I can figure out, oh, I can actually take those, I can add the constant values together by hand in the compiler and produce the result in a single instruction. So now I've taken two instructions and made them one.
Excellent.
That case, the two adds, isn't something that our optimizer is actually going to miss. I just bring it up as a sort of easy example. Mm-hmm. But you can understand there's lots of different combinations of instructions that we can look at and go, oh, in fact, we don't need to do all this work. We can actually do this, produce the same bits in a smaller instruction sequence. And by doing that, we make your code faster.
Absolutely.
The other one is that I mentioned is register allocation. There's a fixed number of fast, high-speed memory on the chip. For an x64 processor, they have 16 registers. And if you use those really wisely, you do less swapping of memory from, I'm sorry, values from memory down onto the chip. If you swap less, your code runs faster.
Sure.
So these areas on how you take the high-level programmer semantics and fit them onto the chip is an area that I work on most.
Interesting. And I think that's a great point, because when you think about the evolution of programming languages, and this includes C++, mm-hmm. but now, especially as you move into languages like Java and C#, and VB.NET, and all the managed stack,
mm-hmm.
Regardless if it's Microsoft managed or not Microsoft managed, it's still managed code.
Right.
You're actually abstracting the processor further and further away from the developer, which probably isn't a bad thing. And so the onus is going to be on compiler dudes, such as yourself,
yes.
to ensure my super high-level code that's really easy for me to compose
mm-hmm.
actually executes efficiently, securely. That's another thing I know you work on, and
right.
your team does.
Right.
And reliably.
Right.
So it's interesting.
Now, the other advantage you get with going up the abstraction stack, right? I mean, in all these languages, you started out with C, mm-hmm. which was provided a level of abstraction above assembly, but still very low level. Mm-hmm. You know, programmers have to worry about memory. They're still looking at the program as a single flat execution on a linear array of memory.
Mm-hmm.
As you go up, C++ still contains a lot of C. Once you get into things more like VB, some of these higher levels, you go into a Microsoft .NET language like F#, mm-hmm. which is more functional. Mm-hmm. You have a way to start talking about abstractions that don't necessarily fit the old execution model and start going after things like you mentioned earlier, the multi-core, mm-hmm. Being able to parallelize some of these computations.
Sure. And so, you know, that's a good point when you get into parallelization, because certainly the compiler could be, you know, if there was like a switch where I could say, all right, compile Windows, but make sure it can target an insanely cored processor.
Right. Right. So this is great. This is the story we'd all like to have.
Yeah.
Right? But the steps along the way are gonna be small. Right? I mean, you know, you'd love to be able to say, there's the magic wand, and I'm just gonna take it and I'm gonna wave it, and all of a sudden I'm gonna leverage all these cores. Mm-hmm. Right? In a way, the hardware guys have gone so far down on the process stack, right? They're down to almost 32 nanometers of the next process shrink, and they're like scratching their head. They're like, oh my god, this is really hard. Mm-hmm. Why don't we just go wide? Why don't we make tons and tons of cores on the side? So they've essentially said, Moore's Law is now not our problem, it's the software guy's problem. Mm-hmm. So we love to be able to wave our wand and make all of this parallelizable. Unfortunately, the single most important fact to all parallel code is the problem, you know, algorithm or architecture that's put in by the programmer. If the programmer doesn't write parallel, we can't run parallel. So one of the things that we're thinking about is how we can give guidance back to the programmer to say, how can your solution be restructured in such a way that can be executed in parallel? Mm. If you've set it up that you're writing every intermediate result into some array that you need to then as an input to your next step, like the perfectly serial worst case, mm-hmm. it's going to be very difficult for us to break that up and parallelize it. Mm-hmm. But if you've essentially modeled the solution to your problem as a series of threads, mm-hmm. with each having their own block of computation, mm-hmm. that's the ideal case, right? I mean, we can start all those threads up, get them all running, they each go on the core, mm-hmm. and we'll get the answer in however many, you know, divide by the number of threads,
sure.
ideally.
Sure, but of course the onus is still on the developer and with regards to synchronization.
Right.
That's a problem that many developers just can't get their heads around.
Right, right. So we actually are hoping through collaboration with the PCP group, which is providing libraries and new languages mm-hmm. To help support programmers to think better about their solutions. Think about parallelism up front, mm-hmm. and give them some tools to handle some of these synchronization problems, so that we can collaboratively get more parallel code.
Absolutely.
I don't think it's going to turn into a solution where the tools vendors or tools people are going to be able to sort of just make it all go away, and mm-hmm. all the legacy code will run on these new, you know, very parallel cores. But I think that given work by both sides, we're going to be able to come up with a cool solution.
Absolutely. So one of the things I think would be really fun to do would be to have you on the whiteboard,
okay.
or wherever you're more comfortable, and really show us, you know, where the type of code that you write in your day-to-day job, right? You said you're writing C++.
Right.
What that ends up, let's just follow the path down to just before it's going to execute on a processor.
Okay.
You know, just kind of okay. map through the kind of things that you do.
So this is the thing I can actually show you. Let's see if we can get the video camera to work on the screen.
Let's do it. All right. Well, it's a digital screen. So
it's a digital screen, so...
We won't look at your password, though. All right.
Wow, you've actually done that before.
Well, no. Niners are clever. I don't want them to get any.
Okay. So we have two things. I'm going to show you two different files up here at the beginning. This is a file from within the allocator. This is code that's been written in the last 3 months. Mm-hmm. That has to do with figuring out preferences between values for whether they prefer a given physical register or not. So this is used in the allocator to try and get rid of things like extra redundant moves.
Okay.
So anybody here who's looked at C++ can recognize this code pretty straightforward. Forgive me, it's XEmax, but I'm old school.
No worries, man. No worries.
So you can look at that. That's my day-to-day environment. I write just like every other C++ developer. But, I guess the important part, cool part, where the rubber meets the road, I'm going to do a dump from our compiler for a function that computes the values of pi for all the phases of compilation. So what I've done is I'm essentially calling CL, as anybody would. I'm essentially specifying our new backend, which is the Phoenix backend.
Okay.
I'm not sure if this is showing up.
It is.
And then I've got a function pi, pi.c. And then I have a secret private switch that's not available in the retail build, so nobody out on channel 9 can actually throw this.
Okay.
And as you can see, I'm dumping out tons and tons of output. Now this actually starts to look much more like an assembly program. So I'm actually going to just cancel that out until it gets to a halt point. And I'm going to put it in a file, and we're going to go through it a layer by layer at a time. So, we haven't really gone into it in this conversation, but there's really two like broad boxes in the compiler. One of them is the front end that deals with enforcing language syntax and making sure that the program has a, is a legal program.
Okay.
And then that's actually done down the hall by the C++ front end team. And then they give us an output that is then pulled into the back end, and we take the program and verify its semantics and enforce those semantics and lower it down.
Okay.
So let me actually do a so this function is the doit function, and normally we encourage our users to use a more interesting and descriptive function name. And this little bit of code right here turns into this long sequence.
Interesting.
Right? So like you might say here, I have this long D. That would correspond to the assign of 4 to D. So you can see this has been broken down, and you've got everything here sort of compressed down. You can see the assignment of 10,000, 251. All these are values that you see in your program. Then D, R, N, those are all values that are in the program. But now all of a sudden I start seeing things like temps. So temps are intermediate values. They're scratch temporary locations that the compiler generates on the fly just to make its representation more convenient.
Okay.
Like you have an expression, the interior values of that expression may get stuck into temporaries. So if you look at this, this actually looks a lot like a form you might recognize if you'd taken an assembly class, except that the names in the middle, like you see a sign here, convert, multiply, those are they're not a real familiar instruction set that most people are familiar with. These are our high-level opcodes. These sort of capture high-level abstract operations that the back end is interested in. Our high-level optimizer takes these into account and optimizes the code.
Excellent. Man.
So if you look at this, it's like all of a sudden you're like, oh my gosh, this function, which was relatively simple for me to write, is now this much bigger thing. Right? You got this ton of stuff. Now, let me see how we go here. So you can see this, I think, is the top of... This is the top of... That's not it. It's L15, back edge up to here. Here's one of the loops. And it looks like, where's our subtract K? Yes, so this is the top. This is the top of this loop here.
Okay.
Right? So each one of these things is sort of smeared out, linearized.
Sure.
Right? So we've turned it into this real simple world where each line does just one thing, and it's one thing on sort of the level of what the machine would think of as one thing. Multiply two values, load a value, add a value, convert between data types.
Interesting.
So it breaks down, keeps breaking down, and then we go through all of this down to the exit of the function. So that is something we just call the CIL reader phase. This thing goes in and just takes the input from the front end and turns it into this representation, which we know how to deal with. This thing that you see here is exactly the same as this. You could make an abstract interpreter that would interpret these values, and you'd have compute the same results that this program does.
Excellent. And so now then, again, to be clear, this then, as your back-end world gets that blob of code.
Yes, this.
And then you then act on that.
We act on that.
It.
Right. So what happens is that we've gone down a level in abstraction, but it now surfaces all these simple things. It's like, okay, we've got these assignments, we got this math, we have this like loading and storing. We can start making reasoning about the sub-pieces in a reductionist way and be like, okay, what's a way we can reorder them and all the semantics such that we preserve the semantics of the program, but it executes more efficiently? So one of the things you'll hear back-end people say is they use the sort of as-if rule. So if you look at the C++ spec, it has a lot of rules about how correct programs are formed, but it also has this one stipulation that any compiler can optimize the program in any way it chooses as long as it maintains the semantics that are defined in the specification, and the programmer can't see that anything happened. So as long as from the outside the semantics of the program are the same, the optimizer is free to do whatever it wishes.
Okay. But now, so what you're saying, though, is the front end doesn't really deal in optimization.
It may deal in a couple of simple things. It might... I'm trying to remember what exactly is currently being used in the front end. but it doesn't do much. It really has a big job to do.
Yeah.
And it takes a lot of work to figure out and make sure all the types are correct, do all the checking, make sure it's a legal input. And we really sort of like split the workload between, you know, the back end has a much better view and is specializes in that. So it's a little easier for the back end to do it. So this is just the this is just the reading in. So now, you know, with this one view here, we can say, okay, we've taken the program, we've brought it into the back end. Yeah. We're now in the back end.
Okay.
So then we start going through. I'm just going to kind of go through. We have each one, after this, we each have phases. So each phase, I don't know, I want to actually go to the whiteboard real quick here and sort of break this down a little bit so this picture actually makes a little bit more sense.
Great.
So usually you start out with a block diagram. And what we've just seen is the reader. So in comes info from the front end.
Okay.
Right? The reader produces that view that you just saw on the screen. Right? And then it will essentially descend. There are a number of other phases in here, and we'll go through them a little bit more as I walk you through the phase list.
Phases. In code.
So this is like a lot of phases, but this is the simplified view.
Okay.
And so just go through this. We said is the reader. And variations of the output of the reader are preserved all the way through here. They change in maybe the operations they talk about, but their general form, the general representation, is held up all the way through the translation descent.
Okay.
And then we actually call that. So that's let's introduce that. That's translation descent. We essentially have we start high. We end up low.
Okay.
So the reader reads inliner. inliner has some idea of the structure of your program. Say you call foo from your function bar. It may say, you know what, foo's really simple, and it only is called in this one location. I'm going to take all the code that is inside foo, and I'm going to just put it where it's called in bar, make it just one big thing. That saves me the overhead of a call. Mm-hmm. Well, that's great if you only have one. Say you call it a million times from a million different locations. You're not going to want to replicate that code a million times. So there's a size trade-off. So these are one of the things. The inliner will make decisions about what code can be inlined to other code to try and reduce call overhead. Global optimizer. This covers a lot of territory. This optimizes the computation of values. If you compute the value 33 12 times, it may say, oh, you know what, I can save the original value where you computed it once, and I know all the other ones are the same. I'm just going to save the original one and reuse it. I'm not going to recompute it, okay, you know, the 32 other times. It also does things like the algebraic simplification of expressions. You know, programmers, they want to write the code in a simple, straightforward way, and that's what we want to encourage them to do. Mm-hmm. They don't have to go in there and hand simplify all their algebra, all their math, if they don't need to. What we do is we essentially, you know, make the trees as big as we can. We may even glue trees together, and then we do a bunch of simplification, and then we'll break them back apart.
Okay.
This also computes things like the ranges of values, gets some idea of what range they'll actually vary in, and does optimizations like, oh, this is never less than zero. This will be able to reduce cases where you have, you know, hey, if less than zero, well, hey, it turns out this thing's never less than zero. Okay. So I can remove that whole block of code.
So just to ask you, as you go down the translation descent, I'd imagine that we start to spend more time in some of these buckets. For example, it takes time to compile things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So not all of these are going to be equal in the amount of time spent that you're doing your rocket science.
Right,
so is there a fair amount in Global Optimizer versus, you know,
the
inliner?
The Global Optimizer, the inliner takes us some time, but that's mostly because it has to do a lot of memory-intensive work.
Mm-hmm.
It's essentially like reading in other functions and gluing them together. So that takes some time. Global Optimizer is a big one. So in an optimizing compiler, Global Optimizer takes maybe a quarter of the time.
Okay.
I'd split up. I mean, this block diagram is kind of simplified to really talk about where all the percentage goes. But it's a significant portion. Hmm. It does dramatic things to the structure of your program and makes it much faster. So it's worth the time.
Cool. Excellent.
The Loop Optimizer essentially goes in and will say, whatever loop you've created, it may decide, oh, you know what, I can actually turn this around. If you've counted from, say, 10, you know, 4, I equals 10, I less than 20, I plus plus, it may go in and say, you know what, I'm going to start at 0, and I'm actually going to start at 10 and count down to 0, because it's more convenient for the machine to actually do it that way. I can encode that on the machine more effectively. It'll also do a whole bunch of work to try and figure out that, like, hey, if you keep I and J, which are traditional like indexes, into two different arrays around, it may say, you know what, J is always some constant n from I, and I've figured out what that value n is, so I'm actually only going to take the address of the first array, use that as I, and then have that fixed index off so that I end up with what we call an induction variable, and it reduces the amount of data we actually have to track through the loop.
Nice.
And as we know, all loops are super hot. So we want to optimize them as much as possible.
Absolutely.
Right. So lower is the next. This is sort of like the beginning of my world. I mean, I play up here every once in a while, but this is where I really get bound to work. Lower is a mapping. So I'm going to introduce from here down to here is what we have in Phoenix called MIR. So these distinctions are a little fuzzy in the C2 versus some of the other Phoenix targets, but MIR just basically stands for mid-level intermediate representation.
Okay.
Right? So it's not really all that much wizardry, but it essentially means that the opcodes are still that sort of generic, hey, multiply, convert, that you saw on the screen a bit ago, but that the operands, their inputs, are starting to be shaped for the target they're going to be going to. But they still have a lot of loose conventions, so the optimizer can do it. It's free to make a lot more transformations. Once you hit lower, this is where the rules can really change. So down here, we use something called LIR. And LIR, low-level IR, is produced by lower. So this one will go in and essentially expand anything. It'll be like, okay, if it's a multiply on x86, I have this instruction called IMUL. I'm going to pick IMUL to use IMUL for this multiply. I'm going to generate that, and there's some conventions I have to add to make sure that the right operands are present. Well, I have to force it to use a given FizzReg. I have to make sure the types are accurate for this other, for one of the inputs.
Okay.
I put that in. So the lower essentially does the mapping, spreads everything out. You can sort of think of it as taking each one of these high-level things and producing one or more low-level instructions to implement the same functionality. And that's what it does. Okay. So then in our Phoenix compiler, we then get into what we call idioms optimization, which is like combining, you may have like shifts or adds or muls, like I mentioned earlier, that can be combined into smaller instructions. Maybe you have something that's a AND of a mask with a certain value, and then you're going to test if a certain bit is there. And you can actually turn that into a single instruction on an x86 called a bit test.
Hmm.
Right? That kind of work is handled in here, where lower goes through and has mapped it in a naive way as quickly as possible, trying to like keep the throughput down. And then Idioms Optimizer will go in, look at that based on a pattern basis, and then squeeze that down into smaller instructions. From there, we do register allocation, where each one of those operands that we had before, which were, looked something like, you know, we started out with something that was like T2, we're going to descend to something that's like a temp var 2, which basically is, this is a temporary within an expression, this is a temp var which could have multiple uses. Once you get here, you're going to want to say each one of these has got to be some register. Right now, it's just a candidate. Register allocator will assign it something like, which is actually a register on the processor.
Hmm.
So it maps it from this sort of large, infinite set of abstract registers down onto a set of physical registers on the machine.
Nice.
That mapping produces assignments of physical registers and loads and stores for things that can't be assigned. It may be that you say, you've got 22 things, 22 values live at the same time, you got to pick. You can only have 16. Well, actually, you'd have to reserve some registers for the function calling convention and for other purposes, so you actually have less. But you have registers, there's too many live, you need to spill some of them back to memory.
Excellent.
So okay.
Keep going. I'm not interrupting you. Yeah. Now you're on encode.
I got the last one. We got
Important.
One more, and then we're
right
so encode is actually straightforward. It basically says you've gone in and you've picked the opcodes you want to use. You've essentially done the optimization, potentially shifting opcodes in the instruction set you want to use, and you put physical registers on them.
Mm-hmm.
So now you can run this program.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now you have to sort of bundle it up in the actual binary sections that'll get put into the executable, and the encoder essentially takes our LIR representation and squeezes it down into a section and puts it into an executable.
Nice.
And at that point, you shoot out the side, you got this .exe.
All right.
And at the .exe, as we all know, we can run it.
Very, very interesting. And the .exe just contains a mapping of all this information, right?
Right.
So that the machine goes, oh, I know what to do with this. All the registers are targeted.
Yeah.
Everything's just going to be hunky-dory.
Right, right. So each one of these, if you actually drill all the way down, each one of these is actually a series of bits.
Mm-hmm.
That if you mask out certain fields in the record, meaning like, oh, I want to use EAX, or I want to do an IMUL, these kind of things pop out. So what you end up having in the EXE, is you have big sections of just binary data that get mapped right onto the machine.
Mm.
And I kind of jumped over a little bit of a sophistication. The encoder, as all you C++ people will know, actually produces OBJs.
Ah.
It takes one more step in here, the link step.
The linker.
The linker has to take the OBJ and produce
the
EXE. So Phoenix can actually produce the EXE directly because we're super wizard.
Uh-huh.
But because this is the way the world works right now, the linker is still involved in producing the OBJ.
But let's talk about that, because in some cases, the EXE will be relying on the existence of external class libraries, like DLLs.
Exactly.
And so the linker has to link everything together. That's one of the things that it does, right?
Right, right. For a DLL, it essentially has the import library. And it verifies, it says, okay, this reference that I don't actually have in any of the OBJs that I've been given to link, well, I've got this little thing, this import library that says, trust me, there's going to be a DLL that's going to provide this for you. And the, oh, just ask the OS when you start running where this is, and it'll tell you.
Okay. So let me just ask, I want to just kind of ask a random question, as I normally will. As we move, I know if you look at application development, we're way up in the stratosphere of abstraction right now.
Right.
Versus where you are, where we just transcended or transitioned down, descended into. If we go back up through the rabbit hole, what seems to be a pattern in application platform development is there's always going to be this perpetual growth of memory on a machine.
Mm-hmm.
And we'll figure out the many-core thing when you add this tool plus this tool plus this tool plus this tool. It won't be a golden bullet, but it'll be a pretty good panacea. What happens to your world when I'm running, when most users are running on terabyte memory machines with 80-core processors? How important are these steps to still have, you still have very performant code without having to go through such tremendous amount of optimization? Because this is still old school.
It is pretty old school. It is old school. I would actually say that for, on one hand, you have 80 cores and you're balanced, right? You're, the programmer is exposed tons of parallelism.
Mm-hmm.
You have cycles that can be burned during speculation, all these other things.
Mm-hmm.
You could be running and you know what? End of the day, the CPU kind of dependent optimizations may not be as critical for all cases, right? I mean, you'd still like to not use as much power.
Sure.
Right? And if we optimize, you actually use less power.
Excellent.
Right? Less bit flips means less power. So it's like, if you had an installation the size of that big data installation out in the desert, right, you'd really want to, you know, have optimized code so that you didn't use as much power. It would actually show up.
Yeah.
For a normal user, it doesn't really show up. But it is always the case, every time that memories have grown, every time that CPUs have gotten faster, even gone parallel, right? Seymour's craze machines, parallelism, really fast. But you know what? They still hand-tweaked those to the nth degree to get that last bit of performance out.
Sure.
Right? Each one of those has to have threads that are essentially executing, and they've got to produce data that other threads depend on. You can make that dependency move quicker, you're going to get much better throughput.
Cool.
So there's some things, like depending on the structure of your program, maybe you get away with it. Not a lot of dependencies, a lot of spare data, people aren't waiting on it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you start having people wait on data, wait on results of computation, the old tools are all going to have to be there.
Excellent. Now, I guess, you know, maintaining just this random naiveness for a little while, what if you actually were able to build an execution, a virtual machine sort of, execution environment on the chip itself?
That already exists.
Okay.
Today, x86, x64 uses a sort of a CISC encoding, right? Which is a complex instruction set encoding, which implements these instructions, which are not actually the instructions that the underlying hardware really runs.
Oh.
The underlying hardware actually implements this as almost a virtual machine.
Ah.
So this is actually a nice encoding that's more beneficial for the getting data from memory down onto the chip.
Mm-hmm.
But underneath, it goes through a process whereby it fetches and decodes, and that decoding step of that instruction actually turns it into, just like I said for lower, one-to-many micro-ops that actually run on the pipeline. So the pipeline has some of the same things. It has parallelism. It has multiple execution units in there. So it's got, you know, four integer units and three floating point units or some other combination. Those micro ops, once they've been broken apart, can now be scheduled in the hardware on these different units.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of parallelism already exists. I'm very comfortable with saying that the x86 instruction set today is a hardware VM implemented on top of something that, if you peeled the skin back, would look a lot more like a RISC processor, perhaps.
Interesting. Very cool. And so you spend actually a fair amount of time probably interacting with the processor machine type people.
Yes.
Right? Whereas the rest of us don't. We just interact with, you know, Virtualization all the way down.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, no, I mean, our partners are actually from AMD and Intel are both on campus here, and we interact with them on a regular basis to try and make sure that the code that's generated by Microsoft tools will run on the commercial platforms that are out there today.
Sure. And, I mean, at some point, do the hardware people need to make it a little easier for the software people, no?
That conversation is ongoing all the time. That's how we do it. So it may be at times where, like, you know, during some period of a fad, the software guys are winning. We get more from the hardware. Mm-hmm. It could be at some point that the hardware guys are just getting killed. It's like the last process shrink, which is where the feature size on the chip gets smaller. They had some trouble or something didn't work out or it took longer and the software guys have to do more stuff. Mm. So this is a constant give and take, really about that layer of abstraction about where software meets hardware, right, that goes on. And we're always just like moving it back and forth and adjusting a little bit, trying to like find the sweet spot where we can give the best performance to the application developer.
That's awesome. User. It's really a very interesting dance.
Yeah.
So I wanted to go right back to this really very, very useful whiteboard diagram and talk about, you know, we'll get back a little bit into Phoenix now, but like what part of those chunks, and I know that this is sort
right.
of, you've kind of really abstracted it for us, are pluggable?
So under Phoenix, each one of these things is actually plugged in to the client. These
nice.
Are all core components, which are selected by the client and plugged in.
Mm-hmm.
So a user would have no problem plugging in at any point where while you see an arrow.
Okay.
Right? That's the simplest way.
Nice.
Right? You could basically go in, and one of the traditional places you might want to plug in is right here. So the reader comes in, and now you've got this sort of low-level view. This low-level view of the IR, the low-level view compared to what the front end sees. Mm-hmm. And you can go in and you could enforce something like, say that you're in an operating system and that every operating system API call returns an error code. And you want, as a manager, to have your devs always check the error return code in all of their code so that the right errors can be propagated for the user.
Okay.
You could go in and produce an analysis plugin that took a look after the reader ran and made sure that all of the return codes are actually checked.
Excellent.
Right? So now you can enforce at this low level some coding convention.
Interesting.
Right? So this is a nice place to plug in because the IR is still relatively simple.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've gone through here and here,
mm-hmm.
all of a sudden things start getting a bit more complicated. The IR starts looking different. You can make less assumptions about its structure. So it's some place you could also plug into, you know, is right here pretty easily, right? Another advantageous place would be right after lower.
Okay.
So you can plug into these two places, three places, any of these places, but at each point you're going to have to sort of understand a little bit more about how the IR is put together.
Sure.
Right? So there's different assumptions. Now, there's another dimension to this, almost as if you were like going to rise up out of the whiteboard.
Mm-hmm.
Each one of these components, each one of these boxes, we call phases,
okay.
actually utilizes a lot of underlying Phoenix infrastructure callbacks. And we have a model inside Phoenix whereby you're able to attach user code on an event. Like say I add an instruction, add another element of IR, mm-hmm. like we saw in my initial dump, I added that in. The framework will actually raise an event saying, hey, someone's added an instruction. Do you care? Now, it could be that a user, a very sophisticated user at this point, wants to know whenever certain events happen. So say somebody else has plugged in and done some manipulation of the IR,
mm-hmm.
and there's another plugin somewhere else that says, okay, whenever I'm actually keeping some data on the side about the instructions.
Mm-hmm.
I want to know whenever anybody adds one. That event could be propagated, and somebody else could be actually woven in to all these other phases.
Very cool.
And then run code that way.
I mean, I could see that being incredibly useful in a very large scale build environment.
Sure.
Right?
The one downside is that it is super complicated. Right? I don't know if like it's come through in this conversation, but there's a lot of detail. Not all of it's all that complicated, but there's a ton of detail
sure.
around the back end. And just getting all that detail straight takes all of us a whole lot of our time. So the when users plug in, they're sort of having to like jump up to speed on a lot of detail. So it's interesting to plug in, like in the phase ordering, right? That's a simpler world. But once you start like injecting user code in the middle while the global optimizer is working, you got to be extra, you know, top of your game.
Absolutely. And typically, let's be honest, the people who are going to use Phoenix are not people writing a C# application to modify some bank data and then, you know, call a web service and then make a pretty WPF form or do something in Silverlight.
Right.
These are system level programmers still.
Right.
Regardless what target.
And the time scales these guys work at are usually a little bit longer. So the one thing is, it's like, this would be a perfect thing used by a security researcher. So that they were able to analyze the code, legacy code and new code, for defects that might impact the security of the system.
Excellent.
You know, as we can see, we've implemented an optimizer using this technology as well. But you could also imagine potentially people using it to weave in new functionality into old applications if they well understood the semantics. I mean, there's a lot of possibilities to how this could be used.
Excellent. And as you said, I mean, just, again, security, each one of those arrows, you can optimize for security to some extent.
Sure. And we have people working today trying to, like, make Windows more secure who are implementing analysis plugins to analyze, you know, do have someone violated something simple like a buffer overrun. Every programmer has dealt with, like, a buffer overrun. This thing will go in and try and sniff them out. Other places are it'll go in and try and figure out if somebody's done a memcopy. Right? Memcopies, they'd like prefer you in certain system contexts to use a safe memcopy. And people can go through and check to see if anybody's called memcopy, but people sometimes will roll their own. And if you go in, this technology allows you to go in, analyze the program, figure out, here's a loop whose semantic side effect is exactly the same as memcopy. Someone should be calling the secure memcopy at this point.
And then you can bubble that up.
You bubble that up. And most of the time, all of these checks, these are, you know, they come in legacy code. Somebody stashed something in a macro. You know, users are dealing with a huge amount of complexity all the time. So any tool we can do to actually bubble up these issues so that users know what's actually happening on the stack under them, I think this is a good thing.
Absolutely. Well, hey, I mean, we've learned a lot today about what you do.
Okay.
And about, you know, what goes on after somebody writes pretty C# code with nice indentations.
Right.
With good algorithms.
Those good algorithms. Don't forget, if the last message is you want to use multicore, think about your algorithm.
Exactly. And then, of course, because we can't end it when we think it's going to end, because that's not true Channel 9 stuff.
Okay.
We need to know a little bit about you. I mean, clearly, being a compiler person, you must have some experience with language design or be interested in programming languages to some extent.
Absolutely.
What's going on?
So I mostly deal with the back end. I've had a checkered career. I worked with a company that was a vendor for Microsoft.
All right.
Back in the day, and I worked on the Windows CE compiler. So anybody out there who's dealing with Windows CE, there's a little bit of me
in
all that, all the CE.
It's
a PowerPC processor, an ARM processor, x86, there's a little bit of me in there. So after that, I actually saw some sort of far horizons, and I wanted to sort of go off and strike it rich. And I worked for a company in California called Barcelona Design that was doing analog circuit synthesis and actually developed a domain-specific language to capture their specific semantics.
Interesting.
They were solving big problems with convex optimization, but the electrical engineers aren't mathematicians, at least not that kind of mathematicians.
All right.
So I did a little language design working with them, and then as startups sometimes do, that didn't start in as well as it could have.
Sure.
And then I ended up here at Microsoft, back to my original passion, which is back-end optimization technology.
Cool.
So I've had the luxury of being able to be exposed to both ends of the compilation. I've got a feel for what users actually need to express their programs and get work done. While at the same time, I have a deep understanding of the the underlying systems and how they have to be constructed to be efficient.
Excellent.
And how you do the mapping between the two.
That's cool. So how long have you been at Microsoft?
I've been at Microsoft for almost 3 years now.
Okay.
Almost 3 years. Cool. Feels like forever.
I can imagine. You write a fair amount of code, you burn some midnight oil.
I've done the oil a little bit. I've done that oil a little bit.
So what do you think of the C++ team?
I'm having a lot of fun.
Yeah?
C++ team is great. It's really interesting dealing with some of the best C++ minds on the planet. Mm-hmm. You know, it's always fun. And I especially like we've been maintaining the sort of focus on the native developer again. I know C#, you know, and a lot of these the .NET languages, uh-huh. they're real attractive for a large domain of programmers.
Sure.
But you know, they don't solve all the problems. And there are a couple of old grizzled crocodiles doing system programming who need good native tools.
Well,
and I'm glad we haven't lost track of that.
Amen. Well, the guys who wrote the CLR are some of those people.
That's right. Right? That's right.
The just-in-time compiler is not written in C#.
That's right.
CLR is not written in C#. Base class libraries obviously are.
Right.
That's a set of libraries. It's not the virtual machine.
Right, right.
So.
Right. So I think that experience, you know, the experience of the native developer is really important to us.
Sure.
And we're focused going forward on making them happy.
Right on. Well, they really love it when we put these on Channel 9, so they'll be happy again.
That's good.
Hey, thank you for your time.
Thanks a lot.
Great to meet you.
Sure.
Always shake hands.